So last week we were talking about speech act analysis, and we ended when we started talking about felicity conditions. And I said that in speech act analysis, when we're looking at speech acts, we don't judge a speech act by whether it's true or not. You can't really say whether a request is true or not, or whether an order is true or not. It's not really a matter of true or false. It's really a matter of how sure we are that the speech act is the speech act that we think it is. And so speech act theorists call this felicity. Felicity actually means happiness, which is kind of a strange way to put it. But the idea is that if a speech act satisfies certain conditions, then we can feel confident that it's the speech act that we said it is. And really the main thing is trying to figure out what the speech act is. You know, there is a field of linguistics called forensic linguistics. Does anyone know what forensic linguistics is? Forensic linguistics? Well, do you watch CSI? Yeah, CSI. Well, there are even forensic linguists on CSI. It's probably the only TV show where you can actually find someone who's doing discourse and pragmatics. But there are actually forensic linguists who work for police departments and other things. And their job is to look at linguistic analysis to figure out whether or not a crime has been committed or not. And speech act analysis is one of the main tools that they use. For example, if somebody is accused of threatening somebody else, one thing that they've got to do is they've got to determine whether what they say is a threat was really a threat. And so they use this kind of theory. They use the idea of felicity conditions to see if a particular utterance satisfies the conditions of a threat. Or if somebody is accused of taking a bribe, for example, they'll look at the language and say, okay, does this language satisfy the conditions for the acceptance of a bribe? Right? And so speech act analysis is actually quite important in a lot of court cases and quite important in solving a lot of crimes, because what we've got to determine is this speech act really the speech act that we think it is? And the way to determine that is to figure out whether it follows these conditions. And so when we talk about felicity conditions, there are really three kinds of things that we look at. First thing is we look at the language, right? Is there something about the language that can tell us whether this is a particular speech act, right? For example, if I say, I promise I'll give you a good mark in this class, we can say, in that speech act, there is the word promise. And just by looking at that word, I'm already pretty sure that it's a promise. Right? So first thing we do is we look at the language. Is there something in the language, or is there something that's required in the language to make it a particular speech act? Second thing we look at is the situation, the context, and that also includes the people as well. Right? So in certain kinds of speech acts, you need to have a certain kind of place or a certain kind of participants to make it into the speech act. For example, the speech act of declaring people married, pronouncing people married. Right? If I want to make sure that that speech act is really that speech act, certain kinds of environmental conditions must be fulfilled. For example, if I say, okay, I now pronounce you man and wife, does it work? Are they married now? They're not married because I'm not the right kind of person. And so one of the chief conditions for this kind of speech act is you have to be the right kind of person. That is, you have to be a person that is empowered to pronounce people to be married, right? So a priest or a judge or a clerk in the courthouse or something like that, depending on where you're getting married. And even if you are that kind of person, it still isn't the only condition that has to be fulfilled. For example, if a priest goes onto the MTR and walks up to a couple and says, oh, you look like a very nice couple. I now pronounce you man and wife. Like that, right? Does it work? Are they married? No, of course not. Because even if you're a priest, you can't perform a ceremony on the MTR, right? You have to perform it in a particular kind of place, okay? So these are examples of the contextual, or what's sometimes called the preparatory conditions for a speech act to be. And the third thing is the hardest to figure out, because you can look at the language and you can look at the context, But the third thing has to do with what's inside people's heads, right? A lot of speech acts, one of the main conditions is the intention of the person who's given the speech act, or the intention of the person to whom the speech act is delivered, right? So that has to do with, you know, whether you really mean it, whether you're telling the truth, whether you intend to do something in the future. And this is really the hardest to figure out, because you can't really look inside somebody's mind and tell whether they're lying or not. And then last week I gave you an example, and the example was a promise, right? So if something is going to be a promise, it's got to fulfill these conditions. It's got to fulfill all of these conditions. If one of these conditions is not filled, then we can say that this speech act is not felicitous. That is, it doesn't fulfill all of the requirements for being a promise, and so we can have some doubt whether it's a promise or not, right? So the first condition we said last week is that it's got to be about the future. You can't promise something in the past, right? You can't say, I promise I'll come and see you last week, right? You can only promise about something in the future. So promises always have to be about the future. The second thing is, I intend to do it, right? It's something that I really intend to do, and also something that I believe I can do. I can't promise to do something that I believe I can't do. For example, I can't promise to give you $1 million. Because I can't give you $1 million. And so if I say I promise to give you $1 million, right, in your mind you'll go through these felicity conditions and you'll think, oh, well, actually, he doesn't have $1 million to give me. And so he can't really promise to give me $1 million. And so he must be talking about something else. He must be making some kind of implicature. He must be trying to say something else other than the fact that he's giving me $1 million. So I have to believe I can do it. I think I normally would not do it. I think that's a very, very important one for a promise, that we promise to do things that we normally would not do. We don't generally promise to do things that we do all the time. So we don't say, well, I promise I'm going to wake up tomorrow morning, right? Or, you know, I promise I'm going to eat tomorrow, things like that. Because these are things that we normally don't do. So promises we normally do. So promises are about things that we normally don't do. The next one is, I think that the other person wants me to do it. Right? You can only promise somebody something that they want you to do. You can't promise to do something that you don't want them to do. So if I say, I promise, if you don't hand in your assignment, I promise you will fail. Is that a promise? What is it? It's a threat. It's a threat. So speech acts are tricky, aren't they? Sometimes we can use the word for one speech act, but we're really making another speech act. So when you promise something that the other person doesn't want you to do, you're actually not making a promise. You're making a different kind of speech act. You're making a threat. So the next one is, I intend to place myself under obligation to perform the action. And I think that's really the key to a promise, isn't it? That the promise is a kind of agreement or a kind of obligation. So that if I say, I promise I'm going to do something, I'm placing myself under an obligation to do it. And if I don't do it, then you have certain rights, don't you? You have the right to complain or say bad words to me, or in some case even sue me. Right? In certain kinds of legal contractual arrangements, if I say, you know, I promise I'm going to deliver the goods on a certain date, and I don't deliver the goods on a certain date, then there are consequences for me because I haven't fulfilled my obligations. The last four here are felicity conditions that are actually true for every speech act. Every speech act has to fulfill these four conditions, right? The ones above in black are just for a promise. The ones below in red really go for every single speech act, and that is, we both understand what I'm saying, right? So if you don't speak English and I say, you know, I promise, blah, 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 it doesn't really work as a promise because you haven't understood what I'm saying, right? And so for something to really work as a promise, for it to be a real promise, we both have to understand what I'm saying. Also, we both have to be normal, conscious human beings, okay? We can't have some kind of mental impairment, right? We can't be drunk, right? We can't, you know, have any other mental conditions or psychological conditions that would would make it so that we don't really understand what's going on. The third thing is we're in normal situations, right? And so, you know, if somebody holds a gun to your head and, you know, makes you promise to do something, it's not really a promise, right? Because you were forced to do the promise. So the circumstances are not normal circumstances. And then finally, the last one is a little hard to understand. The utterance contains an illocutionary force indicating device. Now, we know that illocutionary force is the force of a speech act, in this case, the force of a promise. In the language, there's got to be some kind of indication that it's a promise. And I think for a promise, it's 9 out of 10 times, it's got to be the word promise. If I say, I will come and see you tomorrow, is it a promise? Not necessarily, right? If I don't come and see you tomorrow, you can say, oh, you didn't come and see me. I said, no, I didn't. I was too busy. He said, well, you promised. I said, no, I didn't promise. I said I'd come to see you, but I didn't promise I'd come and see you. And so a promise is very, very special in that it almost always has to contain the word promise. It can contain other words like swear or vow or something like that, and it can still count as a promise. So it usually contains the word promise to really be considered a promise. If I don't say I promise, then you can't really blame me if I haven't done it. You can say, well, you said you were going to do it, but you didn't do it. That's true. But you can't say you promised you were going to do it, right? So without that word promise, it doesn't have the weight. It doesn't have the force of a promise. And so last week I told you to think about these other speech acts, these four speech acts: a marriage proposal, a bet, a request, and an order. And I ask you to try to list out what you think the felicity conditions for these kinds of speech acts are. So I'm going to give you a few minutes just to talk with your classmates about some of your ideas, and then we're going to have a little feedback. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to divide these four into four groups, right? So four different groups can just deal with one. You don't have to all deal with all of them. So maybe people here, you do a marriage proposal, yeah? People here, yeah? You do a bet, yeah? People here, you do a request. And then people here, you do an order, okay? So I'm going to give you about 5 minutes just to chat with your classmates and see if you can come up with what you think are the conditions that have to be fulfilled for these speech acts to really be considered these particular speech acts. Okay, let's get some feedback. Let's start with Heidi's group over here. Heidi, tell us about a marriage proposal. Now, as you think about these felicity conditions, it's a good idea to think about these three categories, yeah? What is it about the language that I need to make it a particular speech act? What is about the context or the environment that I need to make it a particular speech act? And what is it about the intention that I need to make it a particular speech act? So what do you need for a marriage proposal? Okay, it's got to involve two people. One person talking to another person, right? That is, I can't propose marriage to a group of people, right? I can't stand up here and say, will you marry me, all of you? I love you so much. It doesn't work, right? In any way, in Hong Kong and in most places in the world, you can only marry one person at a time, and so you can only propose marriage to one person at a time. Very good. Anything else? That's all? Just two people? So I can say anything? Do they have to love each other for it to be a valid marriage proposal? Not necessarily. Not necessarily. You know, maybe you want to be, maybe Emma wants to be an American citizen, right? And, you know, I'm going to help her out, right? And so she proposes to me. She says, oh, would you marry me so that I can become an American citizen? It's still a marriage proposal, isn't it? It doesn't have anything to do with love. So love is a usual condition, but it's not a required condition. So we have to be careful. There are some things that are kind of normal conditions, that are expected conditions, but they're not necessarily felicity conditions. because they're not absolutely required. So love is not required for a marriage, but it's useful for a marriage. Yeah? What else? Okay, so it's a promise. Actually, a marriage proposal is a kind of a promise that if you propose marriage to somebody, you put yourself under an obligation. There's some kind of obligation to marry them, isn't it? Right? You can't say, "Will you marry me?" Yes. Oh, just kidding. Right? You are actually, by proposing to marry somebody, you are promising to marry them in a way. So I think obligation is definitely part of a marriage proposal. Maybe somebody in the back, maybe Melody, do you have some ideas about what you need for a marriage proposal? Okay. Okay, so you have to want to marry them. Yeah? You have to want to marry them in order for it to be a real marriage proposal. Right? You have to intend to marry them. Okay? So there's intention and there's also obligation. So in this way, it's very, very much like a promise in a way. It's a speech act that's very, very close to a promise. You know, my niece proposed marriage to me. Yeah, when she was now she's like 12 or something, but when she was like 4 or something like that, she said, "Uncle Rodney, will you marry me?" Yeah. And I had to tell her, "I'm sorry, Emily, but you know that just doesn't fulfill the felicity conditions for a marriage proposal." She's very smart, you know. Even at 4, she knew all about discourse and pragmatics. Yeah. So what's the point? The people involved, so Heidi has told us there's got to be two people, but the people involved have to be of a certain type, right? So what are the requirements for the people involved? Any requirements about age? What's the requirement? There's no requirement about age? A 4-year-old can ask another 4-year-old get married and it's okay? What? They have to be adults, or they have to be of legal age, okay? And I'm not sure. I think the legal age in Hong Kong is 16, isn't it? Right? I think you can get married when you're 16, okay? So it can only be a marriage proposal. It can only be a marriage proposal. And so we can group all of these under the same category. You have to be able, can you see that, able, right? You have to be able to get married, right, for it to be a real marriage proposal, okay? So first thing is, they both have to be of legal age to get married. Anything else about them? Okay, good. They have to be not married. Very good. I can't propose marriage to somebody who's already married, right? It doesn't work. It's not a real marriage proposal, right? What else? Anything about the gender of the people? What is it? Of legal sex. What's legal sex? Okay, they have to be, we can say they have to be of appropriate gender. And that's different in different places, right? So in Hong Kong, they have to be a man and a woman. Right? In Canada, it could be a man and a man or a woman and a woman. But in Hong Kong, it's got to be a man and a woman, or it doesn't work as a marriage proposal. Anything else about the people? How about my sister? Can I get married to my sister? No. Okay, so they can't be related. Or they can't be closely related. I think you can get married to, like, your third or fourth cousin or something like that. But you can't get married to your sister or your brother or your mother or your father, right? You've got to get married to someone who's not related to you. Anything else? Maybe we can say they have to be human. Really? I can't get married to my dog, can I? You know, I can't. If I say, "Oh, I love you, will you marry me?" to my dog, it's not a real marriage proposal because I'm not able to get married to a dog. Right? So they must both. But, you know, that is a unique thing about this speech act. For example, it is possible to give a dog an order. Right? It is possible to make a request of a dog. Right? But it's not possible to propose marriage to a dog. Okay, anything else? Okay, good, good. So, human or ghost? How's that? Okay? Yeah, it might actually be possible. It might actually be possible to get married to a ghost. I'm not so sure, though, that it's possible to propose marriage to a ghost. Is it? How do you propose marriage to a ghost? Really? How do you talk to the ghost? It's very strange. So, I understand what you're saying. Usually in those cases, though, the marriage proposal is not between the two people who get married. It's between maybe the family of one person and they ask somebody to marry their dead daughter or something like that. Yeah, it's a very good point. Very interesting. Interesting point. Okay? Anything else? Anything else? Is that all? Anything about the language that you need in a marriage proposal? Does a marriage proposal have to be a question? Does it? Can I say, I want to marry you? Is that a marriage proposal? Sure. Why not? Why not? I want to marry you. How about, let's get married? Is that a marriage proposal? Not a question. So it doesn't have to be a question to be a marriage proposal. But one thing that I think it does need to have is that it's got to give a choice. That is, for it to be a true marriage proposal, the other person has to be able to either accept it or refuse it, right? If you force somebody to marry you, it's not a marriage proposal. It's something else, isn't it? So it's got to give them some kind of choice. Is there anything at all about the language? Does it have to contain the word marry? Not necessarily. Right? It can be done in a very, very indirect way. You know? Indirect way. Let's share our life together. You know, let's tie the knot. You know, let's be husband and wife. Things like that. It's possible to do it in many, many different ways. And so there's a whole range of different kinds of language. So language is not the key thing. It seems the key thing for this one is both intention and context. Got to be certain kinds of people, right? And they've got to have certain kinds of intentions. Okay. I think that's pretty good. I think that pretty much sums up a marriage. What about a bet? What about a bet? Who did a bet? Allison, did you consider a bet? Lillian? Oh, you did a marriage proposal as well. Marriage proposal was a very popular one. Wasn't it? Who did a bet? Carol, did you do a bet? Who did a bet? Did anyone do a bet? Margaret? You did a bet. Okay, good. So, in order for something to be a bet, Margaret, what conditions do you need? Okay, so two parties, you can say. Two parties. I use the word parties instead of people because you can bet with a group of people, can't you? Right? For example, when you go to the racetrack or you go to the jockey club, right, and you place a bet at the jockey club, you are betting, you're not betting with the person standing behind the window, right? You're betting with the jockey club, right? You're betting with an organization, right? And this is very different from a marriage proposal, isn't it? Right? Because a marriage proposal, the requirement is it has to be two individuals. Right? Whereas for a bet, it can be two groups, or one group and one person, or something like that. So two parties, we can say. So that's good. Margaret, anything else? Well, what do you mean by regulations? So are you saying it's, okay, are you saying it's a kind of obligation? Okay, so that's the same as a marriage. That when you place a bet, you are placing yourself under obligation, right? An obligation to pay the money if you lose, and the other person is obliged to give you the money if you win, right? So this is the kind of agreement. A bet Just like a marriage proposal, a bet is a kind of agreement that places the parties under a certain obligation. Good. Anything else? Sheila, do you do a bet as well? Yeah. Anything else? Okay. So, yeah, that's a hard one. Is it? So, in order to place a bet at the jockey club, right, you have to be at least 18 years old. Right? In order to go into a casino in Macau, right, you have to be a certain kind of person. But is it possible for two kids to make a bet? Sure, why not? We do it all the time, don't we? Right? So the bet doesn't necessarily have to be an official bet with, you know, some kind of official organization. Two people can have a bet just among themselves. So I don't think age has anything to do with it in the same way that marriage does. In that, I think that young people, kids, can bet among themselves, and it still counts as a bet. Right? It still works as a bet, as a speech act. Right? It may have a different, Sheila, it may have a different legal status in that if I bet with the jockey club and they don't pay me their money, I can take legal action. But if a secondary school student bets with another secondary school student and he wins and the other guy doesn't pay, he can't really take legal action. So the bets are slightly different in their legal status. So legally they may be different, but linguistically I think they're still bets. Right, I think they both fulfill the conditions of a bet. Right? Anything else about a bet? You got an idea, Yo-Yo? Okay. So must involve something of value, isn't it? You've got to bet something of value, right? If it has no value, then it's not a bet. Right? Now, you might say, but, you know, sometimes we play mahjong and we don't use money. We just use, like, matchsticks or something like that. So, you know, what we're betting, you know, we use, like, potato chips or something to bet. We're not really betting anything of value. But actually, it is of value because it's of symbolic value, right? You've taken the potato chip or the matchstick or whatever you're using, and you've given it a kind of symbolic value. You say, okay, well, this is worth a certain amount of money. You know, maybe not real money, but we've given it some value. So there must be some kind of objects of value involved in the exchange for it to be a bet, right? If not, then you're not betting anything, right? You can say, because actually we all often do, don't we? You know, you can say, oh, I bet Rodney's going to be late today. And the other person says, yeah, you're probably right, he's always late. Is that a bet? No, it's not a bet. It's just a kind of observation, right? But we use the word bet, right? But it's not really the speech act of a bet because you're not wagering anything of value, right? Anything else? Anything about the intention of the people? Other than obligation? Okay, so there must, maybe this is what Margaret was talking about as well, right? That there must be some kind of parameters, some kind of result, right? Some kind of result that governs the bet, right? That something has to happen, or you have to do something, or somebody has to do something for it to happen. So I think this is actually what Margaret was getting at with the idea of rules, right? That there has to be some kind of rules involved, right? That there's got to be some way to tell whether or not you won the bet or not, right? If there's not, then, you know, it's not really a bet, right? Anything else about a bet? Very good, yeah. Yeah, wants to win. You've got to want to win a bet for it to be a bet. You know, if you don't want to win a bet, then, you know, it's not really a bet. So you bet to get something of value that you want. Anything else? can I say, I bet that the sun will come up tomorrow? You want to bet? You don't want to bet? Why not? Because you're sure the sun's going to come up tomorrow, right? So you don't bet about things that you're sure are going to happen, right? In order for something to be a bet, there's got to be some kind of chance involved or uncertainty. If there's no uncertainty involved, then it's not a bet because you already know what's going to happen and nobody would bet for it. Right? What about these other conditions here? Do they work for a bet as well? We both understand what I'm saying? Is that got to be the case? We're both normal conscious human beings? Does that both of us are in normal circumstances? Yeah? The utterance contains an illocutionary force indicating device. What is the illocutionary force indicating device for a bet? What words do I have to say to make a bet a bet? I bet, okay? Is it absolutely necessary to say I bet? It's usually the case, but it's not absolutely necessary, is it? Right? In fact, you can place a bet without saying the word bet at all. You can actually place a bet without saying any words, right? If you go to the racetrack, right, and you can, you know, point to the horse that you want and give them, you know, $20 or $200 or something like that, and you've placed a bet, right? You don't even have to say I bet, right? So you can use the words like number four, right? And that's a bet, right? So like a marriage proposal, there's a wide range of linguistic choices we have to make it a bet. So we really have to focus on the context again and the intention. What about a request? Who did request? Aggie, did you do request? Okay. What do you need for a request? Okay, at least two people. At least two parties. Yeah, again, because you can request something of a large group of people. Right? I can, for example, request that you hand in your assignment or something like that. Right? So it doesn't necessarily just have to be two people. But here's the difference between this and this. This can only be two people. This has to be at least two people. Right? But can involve more. This can't involve more. So at least two people. Anything else? Okay. Does a request involve a promise? A purpose, right? So you want something. You want the thing that you're requesting, right? Whether you're requesting an object, whether you're requesting somebody to take some kind of action, you must request it, right? You can't request something that you don't want. So, for example, if you say to somebody, kill me, is it a request? It's not really a request, right? Because so when somebody says to you, kill me, right, you think, oh, do they want me to kill them? No. Therefore, it's not a request. Therefore, I'm not going to kill them, right? That's what happens in your mind. Yeah? So they've got to want what they're requesting. Very important. Venus, you have any ideas about a request? Okay, good, good. That's related to this, but it's also very important, is it? That I don't have it. Yeah, I don't have it. I don't request things I already have. Right? But, I mean, I suppose it's possible. I mean, I already have money. I can request more money, isn't it, right? Or I already have a pen, but I can request another pen. That's possible. But you can say, I don't have the amount that I want to have, right? So if I have $1 million and I want more, I can still request for more money, right? But the fact is, what I don't have is the more money that I want, Right? So it must involve you not having something that you want to have. That's good. That's good. How about this? Can I request something that you don't have or that you are unable to give? Is it a request? It's still a request. If I, for example, say, could you please fly away? Is that a request? Not really. So you have to believe that the other person can give it to you, right? You've got to believe that the other person can fulfill the request. Anything else about a request? Anything about the people required about the people for something to be a request? You have to be of a certain age or a certain gender or in a certain place to make a request? No, nothing about that. Is there anything about the language of a request that's required for it to be a request? What? Please. Oh, you got to say please. Well, for it to be a polite request, right? But can I say, give me a pen? Is that a request? Yeah, it's still a request. Maybe it's not a very polite request. So often there are some kinds of language associated with language like please or give me or may I have or things like that, right? But there are actually a lot of requests that don't use that kind of language. For example, do you have a pen? Is that a request? Do you have a pen? Is that a request? Actually, it isn't. Well, I'm intending it as a request. If you don't take it as a request, then you're not understanding my speech act. So imagine the situation. Your friend says, do you have a pen? And you say, yeah, I do. Obviously, the person hasn't understood the illocutionary force, right? Because most of the time, right? When you say, do you have a pen? There are situations where you might say, do you have a pen, where you're not making your request, right? For example, here, fill out this form. Do you have a pen? Right? Making sure that they're able to fill out the form. That's not a request, right? That's actually an offer, right? So it's possible to be an offer as well. But it's possible to make a request in all sorts of different ways, right? And in fact, I think that request is one of the speech acts that is the most complicated, because it's the speech act that we very, very often use words from other speech acts to use this speech act. Or this is the speech act that is one of the most often speech act, one of the most often that is expressed in an indirect way, right? For example, because making a request is a faith-threatening act, right? It's embarrassing. We don't like to make requests of people. And so very often we make the request in an indirect way. Do you have $5? Right? Really means, may I have $5? It's not asking whether you have $5, right? So lots of times it's indirect. These work, these four work, right? You both have to understand the request for it to be a request, yeah? We're both normal, conscious human beings, yeah? Can you make a request of a dog? Why not? Come on, give it to me. Give it to me. Okay. I think a dog can understand your request, right? I really do. So I think for some of them, Austin will say that this is a condition that's true for all speech acts, but I don't actually agree with that. I think that it's possible to deliver speech acts to animals, to some animals, if they believe the speech act. I mean, if you go to Ocean Park and you see the dolphins, they're very smart, right? Dolphins understand requests and dolphins understand orders, right? And I think so. Things about very, very simple speech acts like requests and orders is certain animals other than human beings can still understand these speech acts. And so it's still a valid speech act. If I say to my dog, sit, it's still an order, isn't it? Right? Even though we're not both human beings. Which is very different from a bet. I can't bet with my dog, and I can't marry my dog, right? But I can request from my dog, I can order my dog to do things, right? Both of us are in normal circumstances? Yeah, I guess so. But in terms of the illocutionary force indicating device, again, it's very ambiguous, isn't it? There could be all sorts of devices that indicate that it's a request, right? And so in our particular culture, right, in our particular situation, we know about these, right? So, for example, in my culture, a question about whether you have something is often a request to give it to you, isn't it? Right. So, in different cultures, you'll have a different kind of repertoire of these illocutionary voice indicating devices that signal to us, okay, ah, they must want this. This must be a request. What about the last one, an order? You guys do an order? Andy, you do an order? Yeah. What do you need for an order? Okay. At least these two people. And again, it's got to be different from a marriage proposal, isn't it? Because you can order a group of people as well, can't you? So at least two parties. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah, you must want them to do it. So if I say drop dead, or what is it? Say hoi. Say hoi. Is that the way you say it? Right? Drop dead. Right? Go die. Right? Oh, hoi say. Hoi say. Say hoi. No, hoi say. Oh, hoise. Hoise. Is that an order? Drop dead. That's an order. Is that an order? Not really an order. It could be other. It could be a threat, right? It could be an insult, right? But it's not really an order because you don't really want them to die. Right? Maybe you feel like you want them to die, right? But deep down, you really don't want them to die, right? So the first thing is you want them to do it. The second thing is, okay, let's get to that in a second. I want to think of the one that goes with this, though. You want them to do it, and they can do it. They're able to do it, right? You can't order somebody to do something they're unable to do. You can order somebody to do something that's difficult to do, but you can't order them to do something that they're unable to do. You know, maybe with your boss sometimes, it feels like he's always ordering you to do things that you're unable to do. But in that case, it's not really an order because you're not able to do it. So they have to be able to do it for it to be an order. They are able to do it. And then let's get back to what Yo-Yo was saying. She said something about there must be power involved. Power and inequality, right? So there must be something that can enforce the order. There's got to be some kind of power involved, right? If you tell me to do something, right, it can't really be an order because you can't order me. I can order you. You can't order me. I have the power. Ha ha. But it's true, isn't it? Right? For something to be in order, then the person who is giving the order has to be of a certain kind of person. Right? So this is this second category of condition. Right? That the person who is giving the order has to have the power to give an order. If they don't have a power to give an order, it's not an order. What is it? It's a request, isn't it? Right? So if I say, hand in your homework, it's an order, right? If you say, oh, end class early tonight, it's not an order. It's a request, isn't it? Right? You can still use the same kind of words, you know, the same kind of linguistic form, but it's a different kind of speech act based on the fact that you have less power than I do, right? So I can order my dog can't order me, yeah? My dog can't say, Rodney, sit. I won't sit. It won't work, right? No matter how much she tries to order me, it still won't work. And she tries, you know? She's always trying to order me around, right? But it doesn't work because I have the power, right? So there's got to be some kind of power. Anything else about an order? anything about the language of an order. Can an order be a question? A request can be a question like, do you have a pen or something? Can an order be a question like that? Can you think of an example where an order might be a question? You know, I think it's possible, but not so likely. Right? But I think it is possible. For example, if your boss says to you, oh, Miss Jang, I wonder if you wouldn't mind bringing that file to me. Is that an order? Yeah, it actually is an order. It actually is an order. Even though your boss tried to make it really polite and really nice, tried to make it seem like it wasn't an order, it's still an order. In fact, it's actually quite common, isn't it? Right? Because people in the higher position are able to use all these kinds of politeness strategies to make themselves look really good when whatever they say, really, whatever your boss says is an order, because your boss is your boss, right? So whenever your boss doesn't make requests to you, your boss always makes orders to you because of the fact that your boss is your boss. And so you can't really say no to your boss. If you're unable to say no, then it's an order, right? In fact, that's kind of a difference between a marriage proposal and an order, right? That the choice of response is constrained. If your boss gives you an order, right, and you say no, then you are not following the order, right? And so there are consequences to not following the order. You're going to lose your job, right? If you're in the army, right, and the officer tells you to do something, and you say, no, I don't really want to do that today. I think I'm going to go and play computer games today or something like that. Then you're not following the order, and so you're going to be punished in some way. And so the difference between this and this and this is that these two involve choice. Yeah? Like if I make a request, you can refuse my request. Yeah? You can say yes, or you can say no. If I ask you to marry me, you can say yes, or you can say no. But if I order you to do something, you're not really allowed to say no, right? That there are some kind of negative consequences for saying no. Whereas a request, there are not necessarily any negative. There could be negative consequences. Maybe your friend won't like you anymore or something like that. But there are not always negative consequences, right? Whereas with an order, there's always negative consequences for not fulfilling the order, right? We both understand what I'm saying. Does that work for an order? Yeah? If I order you to do something but you don't understand, right? And then I say, oh, I told you to do it and you didn't do it. You say, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize. I didn't understand what you were saying. I didn't understand. So then that means that the order didn't have the force, right? We're both normal, conscious beings, yeah? Because I think it's possible to order a dog or a fish. Not all fish. Just some fish, yeah? Normal circumstances? Yeah, I think if you're in sort of abnormal circumstances, then maybe an order is not an order, right? For example, there may be some, okay, how about this, right? We're in the classroom now, right? And I tell you to do something, you've got to do it. So if I say, okay, divide into groups and discuss this topic, right? It's an order, you've got to do it, right? But if, like, one Sunday I see you in the festival walk, you know, and we're in a shop or something, and I say, okay, you two please go to the corner of the shop and discuss whether I should buy this. It's not really an order, is it? Right? It's got to be a request, because the thing about my power is limited to the classroom, right? Once we step out of the classroom, I don't have the same kind of power over you anymore, right? Especially about things that don't have anything to do with discourse and pragmatics, right? I can't, you know, order you to marry your boyfriend or something like that. It doesn't work. Right? And so there is something about the place. Right? It's got to take place in an appropriate place. There must be appropriate conditions for it to be an order. For the illocutionary voice indicating device, I think that an order is often an imperative sentence, right? Do it. Shut up. Give me that. Right? But it doesn't have to be, right? Orders can also be questions, right? Orders can also be declarative sentences. You know, for example, if your boss says, "Boy, I'd really like a cup of coffee, Miss Jiang," right? Then you know that it's an order to get your boss a cup of coffee, isn't it? So again, because it's possible for it to be such an indirect speech act, there are a lot of possible illocutionary voice force indicating devices for an order. One of the problems with speech acts, though, is that the illocutionary force indicating devices may actually be different in different cultures. For example, if somebody says to me, "Have you eaten?" Somebody walks up to me and says, "Have you eaten?" In my culture, I would immediately interpret that to be the speech act of an invitation. Right? When I first moved to China, it was really difficult because people came up to me all the time and said, "Have you eaten?" And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know, I've got something to do for lunch already." And they look at me and say, "What are you talking about?" They didn't understand. Right? And so in my culture, this particular sentence has the force of an invitation. In your culture, does it have the force of an invitation? What is it? It's a greeting. It's just a greeting. Right? So things can be very, very different in different cultures. One of the big differences we have in our two cultures, I think, is the idea of an apology. What is an apology? And what are the consequences of making an apology? What does an apology involve? You may remember quite a few years ago now, maybe like 6 years ago or something like that, 6 or 7 years ago, there was a plane in China. There was an American plane hit a Chinese plane in China. Do you remember the situation? Yeah. So the American plane was actually a spy plane. It wasn't even allowed to be there. You know, it was, you know, like spying on the Chinese. And while it was spying on the Chinese, it hit this Chinese plane and it crashed. The American plane crashed after hitting the Chinese plane, right? And then the Chinese captured the American pilot and the crew, right? And they took them someplace and they questioned them and they took apart their plane and stuff like that. And the Americans got very, very upset. And the Chinese got very, very upset. And there was this big thing about it, right? And the Chinese said, "You should apologize." The Americans. They say, "You should apologize. Why don't you apologize?" And the Americans say, "We're not going to apologize. We didn't do anything wrong. We would just fly your plane around in your country. No problem." Right? And it was a big kind of international problem. Right? But a lot of the reason for the problem had to do with two very, very different ideas about what it means to apologize, when you're supposed to apologize, and what the obligations of apology are, what happens after an apology, right? What you have to do after apology. What are the consequences of an apology, right? So the Chinese said, they said, "Well, when you bump into somebody, you apologize." Right? Yeah. The American plane bumped into the Chinese plane, right? And they said, "It's simple. When you bump into somebody, you apologize." It's true, isn't it? Right? In Hong Kong, when you bump into somebody, what do you say? "Sorry." Right? Isn't that, that's exactly what you say? "Sorry." You bump into somebody, you say, "Sorry." Right? All the time. Right? In America, when you bump into somebody, do you say sorry? No. What do you say? "Excuse me." It's different. "Excuse me" is not an apology. Right? Actually, "excuse me" is a request. Right? I request for you to excuse me, to get out of my way is really what it means. Get out of my way. Right? And so there is a slight difference there, that when you bump into somebody in one culture, you apologize. When you bump into somebody in another culture, you make a request for them to get out of your way, basically. Right? The second problem is, in American culture, an apology involves an admission of guilt. Yeah? That when you apologize, basically what you are saying by apologizing is you're saying, it was my fault. I'm guilty. You're right. I'm wrong. Right? Whereas in Chinese culture, I don't think that's true. Right? In fact, in Chinese culture, I think people apologize all the time when they're not wrong. Right? Don't they? Right? They're always saying, I'm sorry. But they actually think, I'm actually right. You're wrong. But I'm saying I'm sorry to you because that's the polite thing to do. Right? So in China, an apology doesn't have this kind of obligation of an admission of guilt. And so this is why the Americans wouldn't apologize, because the Americans thought that if they apologize, what they would be saying is, you're right, I'm wrong, and so you have the right to keep my plane, or something like that, right? And so, I mean, even in a kind of legal sense in America, if somebody apologizes to somebody else, it actually makes them legally liable, right, as the wrong kind of person. So two very, very different ideas about what an apology is. Polish people have a very, very different idea of what this sentence means than I do. So if my Polish friend comes to my house and I say, would you like a beer? Right? I would expect the person to say, yes, thank you, or no thanks, I don't want a beer. Right? A Polish person might say something like, no, I'd like some wine, please. Right? That is, a Polish person would see this as a request for an alternative, right? As offering an alternative, right? So when you offer something, right, they interpret that as an alternative. And so they may not choose your alternative. So for me, when I say this, I'm just offering one thing, a beer. But for them, right, they would think, oh, well, a beer is one of my choices, but what else do you have? Open my refrigerator. There are other choices as well. And so you can see different cultures have different ideas about speech acts. And so when in intercultural communication, when we have some kind of miscommunication because we misunderstand the speech act, we call this socio-pragmatic failure. Socio-pragmatic failure, right? It means that we misunderstood each other. And the reason we misunderstood each other is not because we misunderstood the vocabulary, not because we misunderstood the grammar, but because we misunderstood the pragmatics. Yeah? We misunderstood the speech acts that were involved. So you can see, I already told you that speech act theory is very important in forensic linguistics, but speech act theory is also very, very important in applied linguistics or second language teaching, because you can see from all of these examples that it doesn't matter if you understand every single word of the language and know all the grammar of the language. If you don't understand the speech acts in the language, how they do speech acts, then it's very, very difficult to get along, because so many of our speech acts are indirectly performed. Implicature. So, since so many of our speech acts are indirectly performed, and in fact, so much of what we say is kind of very indirect, often it's very, very difficult to figure out what people mean. People don't actually say what they mean, and people don't actually mean what they say. Right? Very often they say things in an indirect way, and so we have to guess what they're saying. And how do we do this? How do we guess what they say? Well, we use a kind of set of expectations from our own culture, expectations about communication, expectations about conversation that help us to understand what people mean what they say when they say. And when we make a guess, right, then this is what we call an inference. Right? We make an inference about what somebody means. When somebody communicates what they mean, they're making an implicature. Right? That is, they are implying something. So imply means to say something indirectly, right? To hint at something, isn't it? Right? So this is what we call implicature. So how do we make implicature, and how do we figure out what implicature people are making? That's the question. So, for example, if your if a boyfriend and a girlfriend, right? The girlfriend says to the boyfriend, I love you. The boyfriend says to the girlfriend, thank you. Anything wrong with that conversation? It's okay? Are you happy if you're the girl? Are you happy? Not so happy. Why? Because you think he doesn't love you. Right? You think, you infer, you guess, that he was implying that he didn't love you. Why? Because he didn't say what he was supposed to say, isn't it? What was he supposed to say? I love you too. That's the way the conversation goes. I love you. I love you. Right? I hate you. I hate you. Right? This is the way it works. And so, because it didn't fulfill our expectation, we assume that they're making some kind of special meaning. Right? So what I'm saying is not that our expectations are always fulfilled. In fact, very often in conversations, our expectations are not fulfilled. But the point is that when our expectations are not fulfilled, we create implicature. Right? How is Alan doing in his new job at HSBC? This is not you, Alan. Well, maybe it is. Oh, quite well, I think. He likes his colleagues, and he hasn't been to prison yet. What am I saying about Alan? He hasn't been to prison yet. So I'm actually kind of implying something about Alan, right? That maybe he's dishonest, right? Maybe he's going to steal money from the bank. Maybe, you know, he's a certain kind of person, right? So in this sentence, I'm kind of indirectly saying something about Alan. This is what we mean by implicature. So, what are the expectations that we have? What are the kinds of basic expectations that we have about conversation? Well, a philosopher named Grice came up with this idea that we always approach conversation with other people on the basis of one basic principle. And the basic principle is that they're going to be cooperative. We expect people to be cooperative, right? That is, we expect them to have a conversation in a reasonable way. We expect that they're not going to lie to us. We expect they're not trying to trick us. We expect that, you know, they're not going to say things that are totally irrelevant to the conversation. And so he came up with this idea of the cooperative principle. And that is, make your conversational contribution such as is required at the stage at which it occurs by the accepted purpose or direction of the talk exchange in which you are engaged. In other words, communicate in a reasonable way. Right? Communicate in a way that I can understand you, you can understand me, you're being reasonable, you're not lying, you're not tricking me. Now, this is not to say that people don't lie. This is not to say that people don't trick us. Right? But the fact is, we don't expect people to lie. Yeah? We don't expect people to trick us. In fact, that's why they can lie, isn't it? Right? If we expected everyone to lie, then we actually couldn't lie anymore because nobody would believe us. Right? In order for a lie to work as a lie, the other person has to believe that it's not a lie, isn't it? Right? And so the basic idea is that people are going to cooperate. And so he divided this principle into three kinds of rules, calls them maxims, right? And they're called the conversational maxims, right? And so these are the expectations we have about conversation. First of all is the maxim of quantity, right? That is an expectation about how much people are going to say, right? And our expectation is that people are not going to say too much, and they're not going to say too little. They're going to say just about enough to communicate what they want to communicate. Yeah? Second is, it's about truth, right? It's called the maxim of quality. And it's about saying what you believe is true. We don't expect people to lie to us. The third is the maxim of relation, that what you say must be somehow relevant to the conversation. We expect it to be relevant. And the last one is the maxim of manner, and that's about clarity. Yeah? So that's, we expect people to be clear, not to be ambiguous, not to be confusing. Now, I'm not saying that this is always the case, Okay? I'm not saying that people are usually truthful or usually clear or usually relevant. In fact, very often they're not. Right? But the fact is that when they're not, it's a signal to us. It's a little flag goes up. It says, oh, you're not being clear. Therefore, something special must be going on. Oh, or you're saying so much for such a simple thing. Something special must be going on, right? Oh, you're not telling the truth. Something special must be going on. So there's a difference between maxims and rules, right? So rules are things that you have to follow, right? Maxims are just expectations we have about what will usually happen. So the point is that we don't always follow these maxims, and they're not saying that we should follow these maxims either, right? You know, Grice is not saying, oh, if you're not clear or if you don't tell the truth, you're a bad person. It's nothing like that, right? What he's saying is that this is what we expect in a normal conversation. When people don't meet these expectations, they create implicature. They create some kind of special meaning. So go over them once again very quickly. The maxim of quantity means that we don't expect people to say more than they need to say, and we don't expect them to say less than they need to say. We expect them to give us just the right amount of information in the conversation. Second, maxim of quality. We expect people to tell the truth. We expect what they will say is not false, right? We expect that they're not going to say something that they don't have evidence for. We expect them to tell the truth. The third, maxim of relevance, means that we expect that what people say is going to have some kind of relevance to the conversation that we're having. And if they're going to say something that is not relevant to what we've been discussing, they're going to signal it somehow. They're going to use some kind of discourse marker like, oh, and anyway, or, oh, to change the subject, or, oh, by the way, something like that, to signal to us that what they're going to say is not relevant to what we were talking about, but they're starting a new topic. So we look for this relevance. And finally, we expect people to be clear. We expect them that they're not going to try to confuse us when they talk. So, let's look at some of these maxims, right? Some of these sentences, rather. And when somebody doesn't follow a maxim, right, intentionally breaks a maxim, right, we call this flouting the maxim. That's the word we use, flouting the maxim. Right? So the point is that we flout these maxims, right? We break these rules all the time. Right? But when we break the rules, we're trying to create certain kinds of special meaning. Right? So, for example, the question, do you have any money on you? Do you have any money on you? So, we're at the cinema, and I say, do you have any money on you? Right? What does it mean? What do I mean? Exactly. So why didn't I say that?
Too straightforward.
I want to be polite. Right? I want to politely request. I'm a little bit embarrassed about asking you to give me money. So I just say, do you have any money on you? Right? And so I'm actually breaking the rule. I'm not being clear. Right? I'm not actually clearly saying, give me money. Right? But when you hear that sentence, you're able to interpret it, right? Because you say, oh, I don't know what he's talking about. He's not being clear. But since he's not being clear, I can figure out that he must mean something else. Because he wouldn't ask me. He's not really asking me if I have money. I mean, it's a strange question to ask. I mean, of course I have money. I'm not a beggar. You know, I don't leave my house with no money. You know, and even if I don't have any money, I have my ATM card. I'm okay. Don't worry. You know, and so when someone says, do you have any money on you? You're not going to say, yeah, I'm fine. Don't worry about me. You know? Because you know that they're really making some kind of implicature, right? Is there anywhere I can powder my nose? So this is maybe a question that a woman might, maybe not so much anymore. women don't powder their nose so much anymore. It's a little old-fashioned, right? A woman said, is there some... So you're in a restaurant, right? And the woman asked the waiter, is there some place I can powder my nose? What is she talking about? She wants to go to the toilet, doesn't she? Right? Does she want to powder her nose? Probably not. And even if she did want to powder her nose, she could use one of those little things, you know, those little... with a mirror, you know, and powder her nose right there. Why not? You know? And so... does she really want to powder her nose? Is she being truthful? No, she's not. She's not being truthful, and she's not being clear. Right? She's flouting the maxim of quality. She's flouting the maxim of manner. Right? But when we hear it, right, we say, oh, does she really want to powder her nose? I guess not. You know, and even if she did want to powder her nose, she could do it right here. So therefore, she must want something else. She probably wants the toilet, right? And so we figure it out. This is how we figure out the implicature. Isn't my new boyfriend handsome? He has a very nice personality. What maxim is being flouted? Very good. So I'm asking you about the boyfriend's appearance. Isn't he handsome? And you reply by talking about something that's not relevant to his appearance, which is his personality. So what can I infer from this? How do you feel about my boyfriend? You think he's handsome? No, probably not. Right? And so by saying something that is irrelevant, by flouting the maxim of relevance, you've created this implicature. You've made a hint to me. You've said to me in an indirect way, well, no, I actually don't think he's very good looking at all. Right? Well, how do I look? Your shoes are nice. So, what are you saying to me? Do I look good? You're saying I'm not, I actually don't look good. What maxim are you flouting? Are my shoes relevant to my appearance? Yes. So it's not totally irrelevant. What is it? It's the maxim of quantity. Yeah? Because you're not saying enough, right? You're only talking about my shoes, right? You're not talking about the whole thing. I expect you to address my entire appearance, and you've decided that you're only going to address one small part of my appearance. Right? So you're not saying as much as I thought you would say. I could eat a horse. What maxim am I flouting? Quality. I can't eat a horse. It's impossible for me to eat a horse. Right? Even if they kind of cut it up and cook it into horse burgers or something like that, still it's impossible for me to eat a horse. So exaggeration. We often exaggerate. We often flout the maxim of quantity in order to emphasize things. Right? So I could eat a horse. What does it mean? It means I'm really hungry. Right? I'm really hungry. Remember that as a teenager, you are the last stage of your life when you will be happy to hear that the phone is for you. So this is a parent talking to a teenager and saying, remember, as a teenager, you're in the last stage of your life where you're happy to hear that the phone is for you. In other words, when you're an adult, you're never too happy to hear that the phone is for you. Is that true? That's actually false. It's a lie. Right? So it's flouting the maxim of quality. Again, right? Because he's not really saying that, but he's making a point, isn't it? Right? The point he's making is that teenagers like to talk on the phone. They're really happy when the phone is for them, but adults are not so happy when the phone is for them because sometimes it's their boss, sometimes it's their bill collector or something like that. So what do you think of Mark? His flatmate's a wonderful cook, flouting the maxim of relevance, yeah? Implying, do you like Mark? Implying that you really don't think very much of Mark, that you really don't like Mark very much. This is my favorite one. Right? I'm out walking my dog. I'm out walking a dog. Right? And somebody comes up to me and asks me, does your dog bite? And I say no. And so they reach down to pet the dog that I'm walking, and the dog bites them. And they say, you said your dog doesn't bite. That's not my dog. So what maxim am I flouting? Quantity, right? Because I didn't say enough. I was truthful. My dog doesn't bite, but my dog's at home. Right? I was absolutely truthful. My dog doesn't bite. Right? I was relevant because she asked me if my dog bites, and I gave her an answer relevant to her question. Right? In fact, the reason that this is funny is because I'm following these maxims too closely, almost. So closely that I actually flout the maxim of quantity. That is, I'm not giving her enough information, right? Because I can see from the context that she thinks this is my dog, right? I can tell from the context that she's going to pet this dog, right? And so in this kind of situation, I should include the information that this is not my dog. I would say, oh yeah, my dog doesn't bite, but that's not my dog. That dog does bite, right? I should tell her that, because I know that what she's really asking is, does this dog bite? Not really, does my dog bite? Right? So often, you know, when we flout maxims, we also often make humor. A lot of jokes are based on the flouting of different maxims. Husband, how much did that new dress cost, darling? Wife, I know, let's go out tonight. Where would you like to go? Flouting the maxim of relevance, implying that the dress costs too much, right? Implying that she doesn't really want to talk about the dress. Now, when you don't follow a maxim, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're flouting a maxim. Some people don't follow a maxim by accident, right? That they're actually stupid or drunk or incapable, and they mistakenly flout the maxim. So this is called infringing a maxim. Infringing a maxim is when you flout a maxim by accident. When you flout a maxim by accident, you're not actually creating implicature, right? Because you're not intending to create implicature, right? So here's an example from the President of the United States. Yeah? So the President of the United States, George Bush, is talking about Robert Gates, who is the director of the CIA, right? You understand what the CIA is? What does the CIA stand for? Central Intelligence Agency. Central Intelligence Agency. And Bush says that Gates would not routinely attend cabinet meetings, but would take part in sessions where intelligence was necessary for making a decision. And then everybody laughed, right? Because they think that he's not very intelligent, right? And he thinks that, oh, what he's actually saying is, when I make a decision, usually I don't have any intelligence. But sometimes when I want to have some intelligence, I invite this guy here. So it's a kind of a double meaning of the word intelligence. Intelligence meaning being smart, and intelligence meaning what he does for the job, which is spying, right? That kind of intelligence. But Bush didn't do that on purpose, okay? Bush was not on purpose saying that he's stupid, right? He just was so stupid that he said that he was stupid by accident, right? So we wouldn't call that flouting a maxim. We call that infringing a maxim because he did it by accident. Okay, we're going to take a break. Let's take a break, and then we'll come back and have a little exercise for you to do. Okay, let's hear what you had to say. Let's take a look at the first one. So, somebody says, my phone never stops ringing. What kind of situation could that be? It could be the workplace, right? One person could be talking to their colleague and say, my phone never stops. Any other possible situations? How about this? How about a girl is talking to her classmate, and the one girl says to the other, "Oh, do you have plans for this weekend?" And the girl says, "My phone never stops ringing." Right? So many possible situations. So what is the maxim that's being flouted? The maxim quality. It's impossible for your phone never to stop ringing. Of course, your phone does stop ringing sometimes, even though you're getting a lot of phone calls. Your phone is not never not ringing. It's always not always ringing. There's got to be some time when it's not ringing. It's a lie. So what is the implicature created? What are they trying to say by this? Quite busy. It really depends on the situation, doesn't it? Right? So if it's the workplace situation that Heidi mentioned, then it means I'm very busy. But if it's the girl situation that I mentioned, it has a different meaning, doesn't it? What's the meaning? That's right, I'm very popular. Right? I'm very, very popular. So you can see that the implicature is very, very much dependent on the context, very, very much dependent on the situation. You can flout the same maxim in two different situations using the same words, but the implicature that you create might be different for different situations. I love you when you forget to call and tell me you'll be late. What's the situation? Possible situation. Matt call? What's the possible situation? I love you when you forget to call and tell me you'll be late. Late to a date. Yeah. So, girlfriend talking to a boyfriend. Boyfriend talking to a girlfriend. Why? I don't know about that. Okay. So, boyfriend talking to a girlfriend or a girlfriend talking to a boyfriend, and they say, I love, or could it be a parent talking to a child? Yeah, it could. What is the maxim being flouted? Do I really love you when you do this? I don't love you when you do this. Right? So maxim of quality, yeah? Then lying, right? What is the implicature? What are they saying? What do they really mean? Do they really love it when you don't do this? They don't, right? So actually the implicature is the opposite of the statement, right? The implicature is that I hate it when you do this, right? So this is what we call sarcasm, yeah? Sarcasm is when we create the implicature for what we mean by saying the opposite of what we mean, right? That's what we call sarcasm, yeah? The third one. What's on TV? A says, what's on TV? B says, nothing. What's the situation? At home, you know, maybe husband and wife or family members or friends or something like this. And what is the maxim that's being flouted? Quality again. So we have three in a row, that's quality. Right? Why is it quality? Because there's always something on TV. There's always something on TV. What is the implicature? What do they really mean? Nothing. Nothing good. Yeah. Nothing interesting. Nothing that I want to watch. Yeah. A says to B, "How's your hamburger?" And B says, "A hamburger's a hamburger. A hamburger's a hamburger." So situation. Eating a hamburger, right? Yeah, eating. So, two friends at the McDonald's, right? Two friends at the McDonald's, one says, how's your hamburger? The other says, a hamburger's a hamburger, right? What's the implicature? Sorry. What's the maxim being flouted? Relevance, I think. Relevance, right? The statement, a hamburger is a hamburger, doesn't seem to be relevant to my question, how's your hamburger? Right? On the surface, it doesn't seem to be relevant. But we search in our minds to figure out, well, how could it be relevant? Because they're flouting this maxim of relevance. So what do they really mean when they say a hamburger is a hamburger? What is the meaning? Nothing special. It's okay. Not good, not bad. Right. Has your boss gone crazy, says A. B says, let's get a cup of coffee. What's the situation? The workplace situation, maybe the boss is like screaming or something, and you know, somebody from another department is visiting your desk and they see your boss is screaming and they say, has your boss gone crazy? And you say, let's get a cup of coffee. What is the maxim being flouted? Relevance. Coffee has nothing to do with your boss. Right? What is the implicature? I can't talk in front of my boss. Let's go someplace else to talk about it. Number six. This is actually a real situation. Right? A says to B, if Monica Lewinsky told someone that she had an affair with you beginning in November 1995, would that be a lie? And B says, it's certainly not the truth. It would not be the truth. What's the situation? A news interview?
Kind of that giving some information to all those journalists.
Press conference. Could be a press conference, but it's not actually a press conference. Does anyone know what it is? Well, the two, A and B, are not having a love affair, right? But they're talking about a love affair, right? Do you know who Monica Lewinsky is?
Yes.
Do you remember? Yeah? Ah, I miss Monica Lewinsky. I really do. You know, I really like Monica Lewinsky much better than Iraq. You know what I mean? I miss Clinton, you know. All the news was sex in Clinton's time. Now all the news is war. It was much better when all the news was sex. So it's actually a court case, right? It's a deposition in a court case, and B is President Clinton, right? And A is the prosecutor asking him the question, right? And the question is, if Monica Lewinsky told someone that she had an affair with you beginning in November 1995, would that be a lie? And the president said, it's certainly not the truth. It would not be the truth. What is the maxim that's being flouted here? Quality? Manner. It's ambiguous. It's unclear, right? He doesn't say it was a lie, but he says it wasn't the truth. Right? So he was being clear. What is the implicature he is trying to create? It's a trick question. It's a trick question because he's not trying to create implicature. He's just trying to be ambiguous on purpose. He is actually trying to confuse them. And they asked the president about this. They said, you know, why did you lie? You know, he said, I didn't lie. I didn't say that she was lying. I said that she wasn't telling the truth. There's a difference. And they said, well, why did you say that? He says, because I was trying to not be cooperative. The president said that. He said, my intention when I was answering those questions was to try to not be cooperative because I thought that this prosecutor was trying to prosecute me about a stupid thing. Right? And so I was trying not to be cooperative. Right? And so this example shows that sometimes the cooperative principle itself is flouted, that sometimes people intentionally try not to be cooperative, right? Intentionally try to be confusing. What's the implicature? They're trying to confuse you, right? They're trying to be ambiguous, right? because by being ambiguous, they can avoid admitting their own guilt. Yeah? Seven. What did you do this morning, says A. And B says, I woke up in bed. I was in bed. I was wearing pajamas. After lying still for a few moments, I threw back the duvet, got out of bed, walked to the door of the bedroom, opened the door, switched on the hallway light, walked across the hallway, opened the bathroom door, went to the bathroom, put the basin plug in the plug hole, turned on the hot tap, ran on some hot water into the wash basin, looked into the mirror. Ha! What is the situation? Two friends talking. What do you think, Ellen? Two friends talking. Just two friends talking. Right? So I say, what did you do this morning? He said, well, I woke up in bed. I got out of bed. I walked to the bathroom. I turned on the water. Right? Is that normal? What is a maxim being flouted? Quantity. Quantity, because I seem to be saying too much. However, it's also a trick question, this one. Yeah? Because it's not two friends talking. Does anyone know what situation this is? Well, that's a possible situation. And if that were the situation, they would be flouting the maxim of quantity because the student would be saying too much. Yeah? And not really answering the question, why are you late? Defend themselves. To confuse the other person. It's okay. This situation is a law court. Yeah? The lawyer is cross-examining the witness. Yeah? And asking the witness or the accused what they were doing on the morning of the murder. Yeah? And so the witness is answering in complete detail, truthfully, everything that they have done. In this context, are they flouting a maxim? No. Because in this situation, saying every single thing that you did is not unusual. Right? Saying what they're saying is not saying too much. Because in this kind of situation, you're supposed to say every single thing that you've done. Right? And so you can see that whether a maxim is being flouted or not, again, depends very, very much on the situation. In some situations, you would say they're flouting a maxim, they're making some kind of implicature. But in other situations, you would expect them to say this amount. So they're not really saying too much in this particular context. Number eight, what's the time? 3:30. But the point is, it's not 3:30. How are you turning? The point is, it's not 3:30. It's 29 after 3. What is the maxim that they're flouting? Are they telling the truth? They said it's 3:30, but it's actually 29 after 3. Are they telling the truth? No, they're lying, aren't they? They're lying. But if you ask somebody what time it is and they say it's 3:30, but you look at your watch and say, no, it's not. It's 29 after 3. You liar. Liar. You wouldn't do that, would you? Right? You wouldn't do that. Right? So the point of this one is that often we flout one maxim in order to follow another maxim. Right? So it's much easier to say 3:30 than it is to say 29 after 3. 29 after 3 is a lot of information, isn't it? Right? So when somebody asks you what time it is, you expect them to answer to give you just as much information as you need. Right? And so if they say 29 after 3, then they would be flouting a maxim. They would be flouting the maxim of quantity because they would be giving you too much information. Right? You don't need to know the time so exactly, do you? Right? And so in this case, we can see that sometimes we break one maxim in order to follow another maxim. We flout the maxim of quality slightly by 1 minute in order to avoid having to say too much. But again, it depends very, very much on the situation, right? Some situations, you know, maybe you're in a space capsule, or maybe you're doing a scientific experiment, or maybe you're in some kind of context where the exact minute is very important, right? In this case, they wouldn't be flouting the maxim, right? I mean, they would be flouting the maxim, and that would have consequences. But in a normal kind of situation, just casual conversation, then if you say it's 3:30, but it's really like, you know, 29 and 32 seconds after 3, then nobody's going to say, oh, you're flouting a maxim. You must be making some kind of implicature. They're not making any implicature at all. They're just trying to fulfill the maxim of quantity by saying just as much information as you actually need. So you can see from this exercise that whether or not you're flouting a maxim depends very, very much on the context. So you can't just look at the sentence. You've also got to look at the context of the situation. There are a couple of other slides here on the limitations and the relevance and meaning and this sort of thing. I'm going to leave these off and I'm going to go on to the new thing. But if you want to get a clear picture of relevance and meaning, you can look back at that G article that we read for week 5, and he talks about these sentences. And really the main point he's making is that the most important maxim is the maxim of relevance, right? That the way we actually interpret what people mean, for example, this sentence, lung cancer death rates are clearly associated with increased smoking, he says there are all sorts of possible meanings for that sentence. It's actually a rather ambiguous sentence, right? Do you mean lung cancer death rates? Do you mean that people are, the number of people who are dying of lung cancer, or do you mean how fast they're dying of lung cancer, right? We don't really know from the sentence. So the way we interpret the sentence is based on the relevance of the meaning to the context, right? So looking at the situation, looking perhaps at the article where we read this sentence, we make a decision about what the sentence means based on the meaning that is most relevant to the context that we're in. That's really the basic thing about relevance. But you can review that in the G article because we only have a few minutes left, and I want to go on to politeness and face. So everybody knows what it means to be polite, and everyone knows what face means. But the problem is that our kind of everyday popular meanings of these terms are not exactly the same as our kind of linguistic or academic or scholarly meanings of the terms. And so first we need to explore the difference a little bit. Right? So face is a word that I think you're all quite familiar with. For example, I can say Mianze. What language is that? Mianze. Mandarin. Or I can say Lian, also Mandarin. I can say Minji. What's that? Cantonese. Maybe poorly pronounced Cantonese, but Cantonese all the same. Yeah? Mensu. What is Mensu? What language is Mensu? Japanese. Very good. And Che Myon. Korean, very. Are you taking Korean?
No, I don't.
You just know. No, I have a Korean in the other class on Thursday, and she pronounced it. She showed me how to pronounce that. Chaemyeong. Yeah, Chaemyeong. Chaemyeong. Yeah, it's wonderful language, Korean. So you can see from this that actually this idea of face is very popular all over Asia, right? In all East Asian countries. Very, very popular idea. What does it mean? What is a face? What is your face? You know, if I say, oh, give me face. What do you mean? Like I'm supposed to take a face out of my pocket and give it to you? What is face? Respect. So it has something to do with respect, dignity, honor, reputation, these kinds of things. So in the popular idea, right, of face, the idea of face is basically the concept of honor. The idea of being polite, most of us think that the idea of being polite is basically being nice. Yeah, being nice to other people, treating other people in a nice way, right? We think that is polite. And in Chinese culture, there is actually an idea that politeness has to do with following certain rules of etiquette, right? So you're supposed to say a certain thing at a certain time. You're supposed to treat some people in some way and other people in another way. And they have a word in Chinese for this too. Li, li mao, the li, right? And li, if you go back to Confucius, right, li is a whole range of rules about how different people are supposed to treat different people, how older people are supposed to treat younger people, how younger people are supposed to treat older people, how men are supposed to treat women, how women are supposed to treat men. It's a very, very complex system of rules, right, about politeness. So this is the kind of popular idea about politeness, right? And this popular idea about politeness is very, very culture specific, right? Being polite in one culture may be very, very different from being polite in another culture. And this is one reason why sometimes we think that foreigners are rude, right? Because they're not following our rules of politeness. They have different rules of politeness. And so we have this kind of misunderstanding. The linguistic idea of face is slightly different. It's similar to the kind of Chinese idea of face, but it's slightly different, right? Face is basically, like in the Chinese idea, the self-image that you wish to claim in interactions with other people, right? So face is kind of the image, it's like a mask, right? It's the, every morning you get up and you say, who do I want to be today? Right? And you put on a mask, and this is who you claim to be. So you walk around saying, this is me, this is who I am, this is me. That's your face in the linguistic sense. Right? So, again, it's very, very much linked to cultural ideas about what is a legitimate person. Who should you be? Who is the right kind of person to be in your particular society? And we all try to be the right kind of person, don't we? We all try to kind of fit in with our society, and so we put on a face that fits in with everybody else's face. We don't intentionally put on a face that's going to not fit in or that people are not going to like. We try to fit in with our society. As in the Chinese idea as well, you can lose your face. Right? You have to maintain your face, or you can enhance your face in some way, right? And this is something that we do all the time in conversation. It's not just sometimes I give you face and sometimes you give me face. It's something that we do all the time. Every single moment of interaction with other people is all about face. Every single word that we speak to other people has some kind of impact on their face or our face. And so when we're interacting with other people, there is always what we call a mutual cooperative concern with face. I'm always looking out for your face. You're always looking out for my face. I'm always looking out for my face. And you're always looking out for your face. Constantly. We never stop. We never like say, oh, face doesn't matter. Right? It's always there. It's always part of our interaction. There's a sociologist named Goffman, but his name is covered by that mask. Right? Goffman is G-O-F-F-M-A-N, Goffman, Irving Goffman. Right? He was an American sociologist. And he was really the first person who used the word face in the field of sociology or the field of linguistics. Right? And he actually took the idea from Chinese culture. Right? But he modified it a little bit. And this is his definition of face. He says, face is the positive social value a person effectively claims, Okay? So face is some kind of positive thing that I'm claiming. Face is like saying, I'm a good person, right? Person effectively claims for him or herself, by the line others assume he or she has taken during a particular contact. What is a line? A line is my interpretation of who I am and what the situation is that I try to sell to you. Whenever we interact with people, we try to sell them our line, and they try to sell us their line. My line is that I'm a good teacher, I'm a professional, I'm here doing my job really well. That's my line. Right? Your line is, I'm a good student, I'm paying attention, I'm going to get a good mark in this course, and, you know, I'm a great person. Right? I'm always trying to convince you of my line. You're always trying to convince me of your line. Right? My face depends on my line. Right? If you challenge my line, right? If you say, excuse me, why do you dress like that? That's not very professional. You know, you should really like wear a tie or something like that. Right? That threatens my face. It threatens my face because it threatens my line. Right? Because it means that you're not buying what I'm selling you. Right? And I could challenge your line. I could say, oh, you're pretending to be paying attention, but I know you're actually sleeping. You're sleeping with your eyes open. Yeah, I know, you're a tricker. Right? Then I threaten your face because basically what I'm doing is I'm threatening your line. I'm saying, I'm not convinced by what you're trying to convince me of. Right? And so we're always trying to convince other people that we're a certain kind of person, that we're a good person. And other people are always trying to convince us. And the way we give people their faith is that we accept, or at least we pretend to accept their line. Right? So maybe you think I'm really a horrible teacher and this is really a boring lecture and you really can't wait to get out of here in a few minutes. Yeah, but you're pretending to be interested. Right? You're pretending to be interested for two reasons. First of all, to give me my face. Right? Because if you say you're not interested, it takes away my face. But also, you're pretending to be interested in order to preserve your own line. Yeah? Because if you don't pretend to be interested, then I can threaten your face. I can threaten your line. And so we cooperate. Right? Maybe it's a big trick. Maybe I'm really bored. Maybe you're really bored. Maybe we're not really doing anything here. We're just pretending to do something. Right? But we've got to do it. We've got to pretend to do it in order to maintain our society. Our whole society is based on this. If this breaks down, then nothing works anymore. Right? So we have to continue to pretend to accept each other's lines in order to give each other space, in order to maintain main taste. So the important points that Goffman makes is that this face thing is not something that you do in just one moment. I don't just like give you face and you give me face and then it's finished. It's not like buying a hamburger or something like that. It's in the flow of events. It's an ongoing process. It's a constant process. It's something that we constantly have to do. We constantly have to take care of. That's the first point. And the second point that Goffman makes is that I depend for you, for my face, I depend on you. For your face, you depend on me, right? So in a way he says, face is on loan from society. I have to get my face from society. I can't have my face all, I can't sit in my room all alone and have face, right? I need you to help me with my face, and you need me to help me with your face, right? So we need, face is a kind of social thing. It's not an individual thing. You can't have face just as a single person. You need to have other people around. So in order to have our face, we have certain kinds of needs. And that needs includes things like we need other people to like us. We need other people to accept us. We need to avoid embarrassment. If we're embarrassed, then we lose our face, right? Then we turn red, we're embarrassed, right? We lose our face. We need to uphold our line. If our line collapses or if people challenge our line, then we lose our face. And so in order to fulfill these face needs, we have to do work. It's a lot of work, right? And we call this work face work. So face work basically means the strategies that we use to enhance our own face and enhance your face, right? And that's what we're going to be talking about in this unit, is what exactly are those strategies that we use. These strategies are very important. Goffman calls them the traffic rules of social interaction, right? Because not only do these strategies help us to enhance our faith, they also give each other important information about how we feel about each other and how we feel about the situation. Who's more powerful, who's less powerful. How close we feel, how friendly we are, or how distant we are in the situation. And so we basically organize our relationships based on these facework strategies. Right? Some of these facework strategies are strategies that we use in order to preserve our own face. These are called defensive strategies, right? And some of them are strategies that we use to help other people to keep their face, and they're called protective orientation. So we protect other people, we defend ourselves, and we protect other people. Do you know what H is? Hearer. Okay? S, speaker, H, hearer. Of course, it's not universal in all cultures. Different cultures are going to have different ways of saving each other's faces, different ways of doing face work. And this, again, is one of the big problems with intercultural communication, because somebody from another culture may actually be trying to give me face, but I don't recognize their strategy. And so I'm not able to get face from their strategy, right? Because we're using different kinds of strategies. So the linguistic meaning of face is basically the negotiated public image mutually granted each other by participants in communication. Politeness, the linguistic definition of politeness, has nothing to do with being nice. And it has nothing to do with saying please or thank you or anything like that. It's basically the way we signal to each other when we're communicating what our relationship is. Right? The way we show to other people what our relationship is. So you can even use foul language, and it's still a kind of politeness. Right? Because by using foul language, you are showing a signal about how you feel about the other person. So it is a kind of politeness. It's not being polite in the ordinary sense, but it is under the category of politeness. So we would study it under the category of politeness. So look at this. Is this sentence polite? Miss Jen, I wonder if you could please get back to me on this matter at your earliest convenience. Sounds very polite, doesn't it? So if a boss says this to the secretary, very polite. Right? Suppose if a boyfriend says this to their girlfriend. Is it polite? Oh, it's terrible, isn't it? I mean, if you're the girl, you feel terrible. You feel like, oh, is he mad at me? Or what's the implicature? You know, what's he saying? You know, he's calling me Miss Jang, you know? He's not calling me honey. What's wrong? You know? So we think you would think that they're actually being impolite to you in some way. Yemogaucho. So if you say this to your boss, is polite or impolite? Impolite. But suppose you say it to your best friend. Is it impolite? Like, you know, if you're chatting with your best friend, you know, and you say, blah, 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 yeah, well, gotcha. Right? Is your friend going to say, what? You're so impolite, so rude to say that to me. Of course not. Right? In fact, it's a kind of way of being friendly, isn't it, to say that to your friend. It's a kind of, you know, way of showing you're really good friends and, you know, we can talk like this. Right? So in that situation, it's a kind of way of being polite. Hello. Hi, Rodney. Can you guess who this is? I used to live in Taiwan, and this is a very, very popular strategy in Taiwan, especially among Taiwanese women, that there have been academic articles written about this. Right? It's called invited guessing. Right? When you call somebody up and you don't tell them who you are, you say, hi, you know who I am? No. And it used to drive me crazy. I used to get so mad when I was in Taiwan. I used to scream in the phone and say, no, I don't know who you are. I don't care. Because for me, it was really embarrassing. It was like, well, suppose I guess wrong, you know? Like, are you Mary? No. Are you Sally? No. Are you? Right? I didn't know. So for them, it was considered very polite, very, very nice. A way to show that you're friendly to somebody, to invite them to guess who you are, right? But for me, I considered it very rude because in my culture, you know, when you call somebody, you're supposed to say, "Hi, this is Mary," or "How are you?" And, you know, so you know how to do the conversation. And so what might be considered polite in one culture might be considered quite impolite in another culture. "Wow, you look awful today. Is there anything wrong?" Is it polite? Depends on who you're talking to, right? If I say it to my boss, probably not polite. If I say it to my friend, it's probably polite, right? Which brings me to my mother. My mother, my dear, dear mother. Yeah? My mother doesn't travel very much, you know. She's only been outside of the United States one time. Right? Once she decided that she would take a trip to England, yeah, and, you know, see those soldiers with the furry hats and stuff like that. She really wanted to do that. So she took a trip to England. And then after her trip, I called her up on the phone and I said, "Hi, Mom, how was your trip to England?" And she said, "Oh, not so good." I said, "What's wrong? Didn't you like England?" And she said, "Well, England was okay. I liked England. The problem was the English. I didn't like the English people." I said, "You didn't like the English people? What's wrong with English people?" And she said, "Well, they are just so impolite, so rude." And I said, "Mom, I never thought that English people were impolite or rude. That's strange. Why do you think that they're impolite?" And she said, "Let me give you an example. One day, while I was in England, I decided to go to a restaurant and have something to eat. And so I went to a restaurant, and I sat down at a table, and I started to have something to eat, and this woman, this English woman, came into the restaurant and sat down at the table with me." And I said, "Well, Mom, you have to understand, you know, different cultures are different, and, you know, the restaurant practices might be different. Maybe in England, you know, if you go into a crowded restaurant and there's no empty table, then it's okay to sit in a table with somebody else. You know, you shouldn't get upset about that." She said, "Well, that's not what I was upset about." Right? I said, "Well, what was it?" She said, "Well, this woman, not only did she sit down at the same table with me, you know what she did then?" I said, "What?" "Well, she reached into her bag and she took out a book and she started reading." Oh, so rude. Now, the reason my mother thought that the woman was being rude is because in my country, when you sit down in a public place with a stranger, such as a restaurant or a bus or an airplane, what you are supposed to do is talk. What you are supposed to do is have a friendly conversation. Tell them about your children, show them pictures of your children and your dog, tell them about the diseases you have, you know, all sorts of things, right? This is the way to be polite in America. So if you go to America, remember that, okay? That if you're with a stranger in a public place, you should talk. If you don't talk, it's considered rude, right? For the British people, it's the opposite, right? The woman in the restaurant was actually trying to be polite, right? She was trying to be polite by not bothering my mother, right? By not interfering with my mother. In fact, she took out a book as a signal. The signal was, "See, I'm not going to bother you. Don't worry. Everything's okay." Right? So she was actually trying to be polite, whereas my mother thought that she was actually being rude. And so what this story shows, what this story demonstrates, is what I call the paradox of face. Paradox of face. What does paradox mean? What is paradox? You ever hear this word, paradox? Paradox means contradiction. Contradiction. A seeming contradiction, right? What does contradiction mean? What does contradiction mean? What does contradiction mean in Chinese? Mao Dun. Mao Dun. You know the story of Mao Dun, yeah? The spear and the shield, right? A salesman selling spears and shields. says, this spear is so good it can go through any shield. This shield is so good, no spear can go through it. It's a contradiction. It doesn't make sense. Right? But I think this is a great word. I love this word. Right? Because this word shows so clearly the paradox of faith, the paradox of politeness, the fact that there are actually two different ways of being polite. Yeah? One way is the spear. Yeah? Reaching out and touching somebody with your spear, right? Making contact with people is a way to be polite, right? But the other way to be polite is the shield, right? Cutting yourself off from other people, leaving other people alone, giving other people their space is another way of being polite, right? And so when we talk about politeness and we talk about face, it's always about this problem. We have two different kinds of face needs. The first need is we want people to like us. Yeah? We want people to be friendly to us. We want people to make us feel like we're a good person, right? We want people to, you know, ask us about our children and stuff like that, right? We want people to have a conversation with us. At the same time, we also want people to respect us. And often respecting us means leaving us alone, yeah? Not interfering with us, giving us space, right? And the problem is that respect and friendliness are expressed in two totally different ways. It's difficult to respect somebody and be friendly to them at the same time. And this is basically the paradox of face, that we don't just have one face. We have two faces, right? One face is what we call our positive face. Yeah? Positive face. The positive face is basically our desire for people to like us, to acknowledge us, not to ignore us, to show us some kind of friendliness, right? To say, "Hi, Alan, so wonderful to see you. You look great today. Is that a new haircut? I love that orange. It looks so great on you," right? And we also have another face, and this is what we call our negative face. Now, when I say negative face, I don't mean negative in a bad way, right? It's just like on a battery, you know, plus and minus, that kind of negative. And our negative face is our desire to be free of being bothered by people, to be able to make our own decisions, to be autonomous, not to be bothered by other people, for other people to respect our privacy. So each of these, we use different kinds of strategies. And this is what's so difficult about being polite, because when we're polite to other people, we've got to figure out which face to give them, because we can't give them both faces at once, right? So we have to figure, are we going to give them negative face, or are we going to give them positive face? In other words, are we going to use negative face strategies, like the woman in England taking out her book? She was using a negative face strategy. Or are we going to be like my mother? Are we going to expect a positive face strategy by having a conversation, talking about our dogs and our children and things like this? And so this is the fundamental problem of face. This is the paradox of face. And this is the challenge that we have whenever we try to be polite to somebody. We always have to juggle these two kinds of faces. We always have to figure out, should I be negative? Should I be positive? Should I be friendly? Should I be respectful? And we have to kind of figure out how to do it. And so we'll continue this conversation next week, right, about exactly the kinds of strategies we use to solve this problem. Hi, Tony. How you doing? Long time no see.
Yeah, I'll try my best.
Yeah, I got your assignment. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, just try your best. Keep keep trying to keep up with the lectures. Are you listening to the podcast?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Great. Yeah, I just go to went to work 9 and 9, and then go to lunch. And
you have to work good 8.
Well, anyway, it's nice of you to come by. Nice to see you.